You're listening to the podcast of Studium Generale University of Twente, with inspiring stories about science and the world.
Welcome at this session with philosopher Johnny Suraker. Johnny is going to talk about his favorite philosopher, René Descartes.
Okay, thank you, Peter, for inviting me to this. You might not believe this, but as a philosopher, you rarely get the chance to rant about your favorite philosopher for an hour, which is what I'm going to do today. That is also a bit of a problem because Descartes really is my favorite. I refer to myself as a Cartesian on occasion, which is a swear word in modern philosophy. I'll try to explain why I still do it. It also means that I have a hard time restricting myself, so I'm going to try to stay on my toes and not to digress too much, but I have a sense that I might have to speed things up a bit towards the end. But I'm going to try to leave some room for questions at the end as well, and please just interrupt me at any time if you want to ask something as we go through this. I'm not a big fan of biographies and so on. If we are too big fans of a biography, we can't read Heidegger or anybody. So I'm going to give a little bit of background for Descartes because it is a bit important to understand where he's coming from and the tradition he's coming from. He is generally regarded as the father of modern Western philosophy. He was born in La Haye, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce that in French because my French is worse than my Dutch. He was born in this town in France, which was actually dubbed after his legacy, so that town is now called Descartes in France. He initially started studying law, but he quite quickly got sick of that. So as he puts it himself, he spent the rest of his youth basically just traveling around, trying to gather experiences. He basically did what students do these days, just travel the world to gain some experience and see what the hell is going on around in this crazy little world. He ended up in the Netherlands, and I kind of like that twist there because Descartes and Netherlands go hand in hand, as I'll get back to in a moment as well. In 1618, he joined the Dutch States Army, the Staatsleger, in Breda, and while part of this army was stationed in Neuburg, he was basically caught victim of this horrible winter storm, and he had to seek refuge in a little cabin. And according to his own story, in this cabin was where he had his revelations, where he suddenly understood everything there is to understand and how to start philosophy from scratch, a new unshakable philosophy. He wrote that up in his two most important works, Discourse on the Method and Meditations on First Philosophy. They are both quite remarkable, partly because it took him a long time to finally publish all of this. As you can see, he had his revelation back in 1619, and it took almost 20 years before he actually got things out. So it's not just philosophers today who are a bit slow with publishing. His Meditations on First Philosophy, which is what I'm going to focus on today, is also quite remarkable because it's almost like a modern blog. He actually published this, and then he sent it around to all the big guys of the time, people like Hobbes and Gassendi. So in the second edition of this book, he has replies, and then he has comments on those replies again. So a little bit like a modern sort of newspaper, except it wasn't full of hate and racism. But there we go. He was indeed 20 years in the Netherlands, in all kinds of weird places, most of which I have a bit of a problem pronouncing, including Oostkreest. And he actually traveled around the Netherlands in many, many different places, including Deventer close by. And it was during those 20 years in the Netherlands that he wrote most of his work. He was, I should say, by the way, I'm Norwegian, which kind of explains my disdain for Scandinavia, and I blame Scandinavia for the death of Descartes as well. He had to go teach the princes of Sweden, and the princes of Sweden insisted on lectures at 5 a.m. in the morning during winter. And he died of pneumonia just quickly after that. Bit of a sad story. I need to say a little bit about his tradition and where he comes from as well. So Descartes was sort of the culmination of the scientific revolution. And the scientific revolution was this great upheaval of science and philosophy, basically finally, slowly but surely, toppled Aristotle off the throne. The Aristotelian worldview had been reigning for 2,000 years until Copernicus and Galileo and Kepler and Brahe and those guys finally made some sense out of the world, and we got rid of a lot of that Aristotelian crap, to use it a technical term. In the Aristotelian worldview, just to quickly remind you of that, the world was geocentric, so the Earth was in the center of the universe. heavy bodies would fall faster than light objects, the kind of stuff that Galileo sort of disproved when he threw the balls out of the Tower of Pisa. There was this really sharp distinction between the Earth and the heavens, and you would have different sciences for the Earth and for the universe out there. And there was a lot of other stuff, which I'm not going to go too much into detail with, but a lot of this changed. One of the reasons why the scientific revolution came was not just that people were fed up with tradition and that people saw problems with it, it was also that it became so complex. Because Aristotle sort of started off on the wrong foot, but then he got sort of married to religion, and Aristotle was the final word on how the world looks, but it started becoming more and more shaky. So a lot of what they did during the Middle Ages was to add this tiny hypothesis to Aristotle, just to continuously save Aristotle every time they observed something in the skies that didn't sort of fit with the Aristotelian view. So this is sort of the image of the heavens. They ended up with this really weird stuff where you have different planes circling around each other, and this was only just to explain how you could have a retrograde motion of planets and all that kind of stuff. I wish I could say much more about this, but I have to quickly move on. So after the scientific revolution, as most of you know, we went from this Earth-centric, this geocentric view, to the heliocentric, where the sun is in the center of our solar system at least, where gravity is constant for bodies in the same frame, and you don't need a force to maintain velocity, you need a force to change velocity. So a lot of these scientific principles were changed. It's called the Copernican Revolution, but I think we should call it the Galilean Revolution, because really it was Galileo who did most of this work, and it was just an easy thing to do for Newton to sort of hit the final nail in the coffin. So science was brand new, but what they still lacked was a philosophy to underpin this science, to justify that the way Galileo and those guys had been doing it was the right way to do it. And that's where Descartes ultimately comes into the picture. This lecture, this Studium Generale series, is going to be, I'm pretty sure, a lecture about white men through the history of philosophy, because that's pretty much what history of philosophy is about. So I just wanted to give a shout out to the women in history of philosophy as well. In a very recent article, actually, it's been unearthed that a lot of Descartes' ideas actually came from Teresa of Avila. His evil genius argument and many of the steps in the meditations, he basically just stole from her, because she's a woman after all, and nobody's going to remember her, and he was right about that. So that was just a shout out. Now I'm going to get to his Cogito Ergo Sum pretty quickly, but what a lot of people tend to not know about Descartes is that he is also the father of a lot of modern mathematics as well. And in a very revolutionary way that is hard to fathom today, because we take it so much for granted. But he revolutionized mathematics by providing this first sort of link between Euclidean geometry and algebra. And if you, for the mathematicians in the crowd, you might sort of salute Descartes for this. For those of you who hate mathematics, you might blame Descartes for this. But if you were struggling with coordinate systems and vectors in high school, Descartes is the man to blame for that. He basically invented the whole notion of having a coordinate system, of placing numbers in that coordinate system, and do mathematics on that basis. He also did quite revolutionary things that, again, we take this for granted today, especially the mathematicians out there, but it was quite sensational for the day. Because in Aristotle's view, you cannot take something and divide it into its parts and study the parts and then learn something about the whole thing. That is just a stupid way of doing things. But Descartes was the one who revolutionized this way of thinking about science. That if you want to understand something complex, you have to take it apart into its constituent parts, study each one of those parts, and then put it all together again and see how it works. Now, this completely radically new way of thinking allowed him to think about things like vectors, for instance. Just the fact that you have a motion, and you divide that motion up into an x and a y direction, and then the real motion is the sum of those two, completely revolutionary. So again, we have Descartes to thank for this, and this is, of course, the foundation of a lot of modern mathematics, of computer graphics, of what have you. I'm going to get back to this a little bit later as well. He proposed a very famous method, and his method is again, for the engineers in the room, I think you'll recognize this from this sort of reverse engineering way of thinking. I think maybe many of you engineers are here today because as a child, you would take your dad's radio and pick it apart and see how it worked. And that was sort of the way to do science as well, according to Descartes. First of all, get rid of the things you thought you knew, get rid of tradition, only accept as true that which is clear and distinct, as you put it, which is going to be very important in a little while. After that, don't try to understand the whole system, try to understand the individual components. And then afterwards, you can start putting things together again, and then you really understand what is going on. Once you've taken apart the transistors and so on, that's when you understand how the radio actually works. And talking about radio sort of reveals how old I am, but whatever. He also wanted to apply this method of doubt, this sort of scientific method, to his own philosophy. Can we do the same with philosophy, not just with scientific phenomena? Now, in order to do that, he was very much inspired by Euclid. If you don't recall Euclid, one of the great things that Euclid did back in the day was that he basically designed geometry from the bottom up. So Euclid would start with something absolutely indubitable, something none of us can doubt. So he would start out simply by defining a point. A point is simply something that doesn't have any extension. That's the definition of a point. And then he went on from there and said, hey, if you have two points, the shortest distance between those two points is a line. And then he went from there and defined what a triangle is, what it means to have parallel lines, and he basically built up all of geometry to the small steps where you cannot doubt the beginning and you cannot doubt any of the transitions as you go through. So you're building geometry on rock solid bottom, and that was the way to do science according to Euclid, and that's also how to do philosophy according to Descartes. And he did that mostly, or at least the most accessibly, in his very famous Meditations of First Philosophy. He intended to have this method do the same, and what I'm going to do is something that I don't very often do, because I absolutely hate PowerPoint karaoke, but I'm going to do a little bit of that, because if you read any philosophy at all, please read Descartes, because he is so easy to read. He basically takes you by the hand and guides you through his arguments, and it's just a breeze to read it. So I actually want to try to outline his arguments by showing his actual quotes, what he actually said, just to show you a bit how succinctly and easily understandably he actually writes. So the way I'm going to do this, I'm going to outline this whole argument. I'm going to keep it on the left side. I'm going to keep each step of the argument so that you can sort of follow where we are at any given point, and I'll elucidate each one of them as I go through them. And I hope this will make sense. As I said, he wants to get started with something absolutely indubitable, something you cannot doubt at all, something that is as certain as the fact that a point is something that has no extension, as secure as Euclid's foundation. And the first thing he does is just to start doubting everything. And philosophy had a long tradition by this time to doubt the senses. Ever since Plato and so on, the senses, the thing we see with our eyes and so on, are basically sort of filthy, disgusting things. Basically anything having to do with the body is filthy, disgusting, which is of course what religion really brought home at some point. So he started out doubting the senses, doubting his eyes, doubting his ears. Can I use these things to get any kind of knowledge about the world out there? And in particular, can I get any certain knowledge by using my senses? Is there something I cannot doubt at all when I use my senses? And he used two very famous arguments against trusting your senses. The first of them is known as the Vax argument. And again, I just want to write exactly what he says here, because he does this in a very elegant way. He basically holds this piece of wax, and he sees that this piece of wax has certain properties, and then he holds it towards the fire and sees what happens then. And in his own words, what remains of the taste is exhaled, the smell evaporates, the color alters, the figure is destroyed, the size increases, and it becomes liquid, it heats, scarcely can one handle it, and when one strikes it, now no sound is emitted. So all the different sensory apparatus I have, like everything changes, all the properties of this piece of wax have changed. But still, I'm talking about the same object in some kind of way. So how can it be the same object when every property has changed? Like, this must surely mean that our senses are not very reliable. But is this just a freak, weird incident? Is this just sort of things that happen once in a while? No, we might be sort of constantly deluded, according to Descartes. And this is where he brings out his very famous dream argument. In his own words, "On many occasions I have in sleep been deceived by similar illusions, and in dwelling carefully on this reflection, I see so manifestly that there are no certain indications by which we may clearly distinguish wakefulness from sleep." And in a manner, if anybody out there now can give me an argument that clearly demonstrates that you are not sleeping right now, that you are not dreaming right now, can anybody prove that you're not dreaming right now? You can't really. You have really weird dreams being in a Descartes lecture, but still, there's nothing you can do to prove that this is not a dream. So you might feel like this is real, but it might just be a dream, and you might wake up in 2 minutes from now on and be late for the bus. That is the reality. So in other words, our senses cannot be trusted. Our senses cannot give us any kind of indubitable evidence that there is a world out there even. Like, we can be completely deluded about what the outside world is like. So, and this is no big surprise, philosophers have been talking about this for 2,000 years by now, that these senses of ours, they can't really be trusted. What we can trust, though, philosophers have been saying up until now, we can trust our rationality, our mathematical faculty, our intellectual abilities. That's where real truth can be found. Well, Descartes was not as sure about that either, so he wanted to also, can I doubt my rationality as well? And this is where he brings out his very famous evil genius argument. This is evil genius in the sense of genie in a bottle, like an evil spirit, an evil demon. And according to Descartes, and again I want to use his own words, "I shall then suppose, not that God, who is supremely good, and the fountain of truth, but some kind of evil genius, not less powerful than deceitful, has employed his whole energies in deceiving me. I shall consider that the heavens, the earth, colors, figures, sound, and all other external things are not but the illusions and dreams of which this genius has availed himself in order to lay traps for my credulity." Doesn't he write beautifully? "How do I know that I am not deceived every time that I add 2 and 3 or count the sides of a square?" So in some sense, it seems that our senses can delude us, but surely we can't be wrong about 2 plus 2 equals 4. Like, that must be true in every parallel universe and everywhere. But according to Descartes, no. There might be this really evil demon that every time you think 2 plus 2, this evil demon whispers in your ear, 4. But in reality, it is 5, and it's been 5 all along. And remember, what Descartes is looking for here is something that's completely indubitable. So yes, it's maybe not very likely that there's an evil demon doing this all the time, but it's possible. There's no way you can prove that there is no evil demon constantly deluding you. So now Descartes is really struggling because, hey, we can't trust our senses, we can't trust our rationality. Is there anything on earth that we can trust? And he just felt like maybe there isn't. And actually, if you read the Meditations, he talks about how helpless he felt and how depressed he was by his latest findings, that all of the world just comes tumbling down in front of me. So this is where he moves to his third step, and that's where he gets to Cogito Ergo Sum. And as he puts it himself, "I do not see in what manner I can resolve these doubts. I am so disconcerted that I can neither make certain of setting my feet on the bottom, nor can I swim and so support myself on the surface." There's no secure knowledge anymore. Until he gets his very famous aha, eureka moment, where he says, "I was persuaded that there was nothing in all the world, that there was no heaven, no earth, that there were no minds, nor any bodies. Was I not then likewise persuaded that I did not exist? But hang on a second. If some deceiver, this evil demon, employs his ingenuity in deceiving me, then without a doubt I exist. Also, if he deceives me. Because if somebody is deceiving me, I might be wrong about everything except for the fact that I am being deceived right now. When I sit there doubting, do I exist? Just the fact that I am doubting that I exist is proof that I exist. And to this day, with some insane exceptions, but to this day, nobody has been able to come up with, in my mind at least, any kind of credible argument against this. And this is partly why Descartes is such a genius and why cogito ergo sum has become a cliché that we tend to take a bit too for granted. But basically, this is the only result that philosophers have come up with in 2,500 years. For 2,500 years, philosophers have been trying to find one thing that is absolutely true, that nobody can doubt, that there is no argument against. And this is the only thing there is. If you are sleeping right now, if you are deceived by an evil demon right now, doesn't matter, you still exist. And that is the only thing you can be 100% certain about. And none of you can doubt that. Because if you doubt that, you have already proved that you do exist. So it's kind of beautiful in that sense. But what Descartes ends up with is that that is now the only thing he knows. He ends up with something that is referred to as solipsism, which is basically this absolute knowledge that you exist, but the world out there, it might be anything. It might not exist at all. I know that I exist, but not that the world out there exists. And of course, this is not where Descartes wants to end up. This is unfortunately where most of us leave Descartes, because after this, Descartes sort of goes off the rails a little bit, because now he has to build the world from this very meager standpoint. Just like Euclid started with a point is something that has no extension, Descartes starts with cogito ergo sum, and now he has to start building up philosophy and science from the definition of him being a thinking thing. And what he needs in order to do that, and this is where you will either follow him or fall off, what he needs in order to do that is God. He can't get away from him being the only thing existing without God. And this is where Descartes has several proofs of the existence of God, and I'm not even going to go through them because they are all ridiculous and notoriously bad. I'm not saying that God doesn't exist, but I'm saying if you believe in God, do so on the basis of blind faith, because there are no rational arguments that can prove that God exists. If anybody disagrees, please come up to me afterwards. So these are the sort of arguments he had, and I wanted to say something about them, but I just don't have time. Just take my word for it. If you don't believe in God already, you're not going to be convinced by these arguments. But he does, in his own mind at least, prove that God exists. And the way he proves God exists, God necessarily has to be omniscient, omnipotent, and benevolent. Oh, now I feel like a TV preacher standing here. So he has this omniscient, this all-knowing, all-powerful, and good God. So now he knows two things. He knows that he exists, and he knows that this God, this perfect God, exists. So where do we go from there? Well, since this God is perfect, I recognize it to be impossible that he should ever deceive me. Like this evil demon that Descartes talked about, like, a good God wouldn't allow that evil demon to whisper in my ear every time I think about 2 + 2. A good, all-powerful, all-knowing God would simply not allow that. But hang on, Descartes. Haven't you gone a bit step too far now? Haven't you just spent page after page after page talking about how often you are deluded and how often you have hallucinations and how often you see illusions out there? Like, you have already shown that you are deceived all the time, and at the same time you're saying God doesn't deceive you? How does this work? Well, this is where Descartes kind of has to backtrack a little bit. He sort of says, okay, hold my horses, I think I've gone a step too far here. Let me sort of backtrack a little bit and make some sense out of this. God wouldn't deceive me willingly. That is inconsistent with being God. So yes, I have illusions and so on all the time, but if I have that, then it's my fault. It's not God's fault. God doesn't try to fool me. But since he was stupid enough to give us free will and all that kind of stuff, then still we are deluded all the bloody time because we are bad scientists. So what, in Descartes' view, God says that if you're a good scientist, you will never be wrong. If you are a stupid person, then you will be wrong a lot of the time. And by stupid, Descartes meant basically somebody who doesn't follow this method of his. And this is where actually things start getting a bit more interesting. This is where actually he starts to really rebuild the world. And now we're going to see in a minute how much this has influenced later science. So as he says, God will not deceive me willingly. We must always return to the point that it is only those things which we conceive clearly and distinctly that have the power of persuading me entirely. So when he talks about these clear and distinct things, he does include mathematics. So 2 plus 2 equals 4 is just so clear and distinct. And if I'm wrong about that, there has to be an evil demon fooling me. And that is kind of what he has ruled out. So you can trust mathematics. You can trust geometry. Like, those things are clear and distinct, and no God is going to try to willingly deceive me when it comes to that. But what about our senses now? Can we trust our senses or not? Yes, according to Descartes, if you are only accepting that which is clear and distinct. Now, what kinds of observations are clear and distinct? The kinds of observations that you can measure. The kinds of observations that you can use mathematics to describe. That is what you can accept. I am able distinctly to imagine and to observe extension in length, breadth, or depth in the object to which it is attributed. So you are not deceived as long as you follow the scientific method. That is, you only accept that which is measurable, that which you can quantify, and that which you can use mathematics for. And this is one of the things about Descartes that isn't as much talked about, but this basically set the stage for all of modern science. Like, if you are a social scientist and your supervisors have been telling you, hey, stop doing that qualitative research stuff, do quantitative research, that is because of Descartes. If you are in somehow interested in sort of wishy-washy things like emotions or that kind of stuff, then a lot of people would think you're not a scientist, and that's because of Descartes. Because if you can't measure it, if you can't stick it inside a mathematical formula, it is not science. Because if you don't do that, you might be deceived. God will help you along the way, I'm turning into a Southern Baptist now, as long as you only use mathematics and only use measurements. So he ends up saying that the essence of the world out there is that it is extended. Everything sounds more beautiful in Latin, so he calls it res extensa, but that basically means extended things. So the world consists of res cogitans and res extensa, which are basically extended things and thinking things. Sounds a bit more vulgar in English, but that's basically what he's saying. So our mind is a thinking thing, and everything out there, including your bodies, are just extended things. And I can only have knowledge insofar as I measure you and put you inside a mathematical formula. Everything else, including things like smells and tastes and things that you can't measure, doesn't belong to science anymore. Now, this raises, of course, an enormous problem. Because if I am a thinking thing, like, my consciousness doesn't exist in space. It's not a physical thing that can affect other physical things. My mind just exists somewhere in me, and you can't sort of point to consciousness and say, hey, there it is, and it got this size. You can't talk about that. Your thoughts aren't like that. But the world out there is like that. So when you hit your toe and you start thinking to yourself all kinds of interesting swear words, and you feel pain and all that kind of stuff, how is it possible that that physical event, the atoms hitting the other atoms, how can that be translated into thoughts and feelings and consciousness? Like, Descartes created this problem for us. And again, I want to make the bold statement that nobody has been able to solve this to this very day. We still don't understand how it is possible that is sort of lumpy gray stuff we have up here, how that can give rise to feelings, emotions, thinking, sensations. We still don't know that. You sometimes see headlines in the newspapers and so on that now scientists have understood this, but no, they haven't. Nobody understands this today. This is why we can't do proper artificial intelligence, because we simply don't understand how this machine can give rise to something as fantastic as consciousness. And there's no reverse engineering in the world that can help us understand that. It remains the fundamental problem in neuroscience and artificial intelligence. Now, what is the aftermath of all of this? Well, there's tons of it, and I have to restrict myself a little bit. But this mind-body problem is one of the biggest ones, which psychologists and neuroscientists are still grappling with today. And following the success of the scientific revolution, so Galileo and all those guys, they show that we can use mathematics to understand the universe, to understand the laws of nature, and to formalize the laws of nature. And Descartes further laid a philosophical foundation for this. Only that which is measurable is allowed in science. Now, what about the things that we cannot see, but we are still using in science all the time? So Newton is, of course, famous for really emphasizing gravity and how gravity is necessary in order to sort of have our equations work. But nobody has ever seen gravity. You can't observe gravity. You can observe the effects of gravity, but you cannot see gravity itself. You cannot measure gravity itself. So how can you allow that in a science where everything has to be measurable? Well, this was actually a big, big, big fight, almost literally, especially sort of back in early 1900s, where this group of logical positivists were really struggling with this question, how can we allow gravity and those kinds of things in our science? And they basically said, we can allow these unobservable things as long as they sort of fit perfectly inside our mathematical formula. As long as we somehow can get numbers that we can fix onto something. If we can say that gravity is a constant that is 9.8 meter by second squared, like then you're allowed to use it in science. If you describe gravity in wishy-washy terms, you're not a scientist. But if you put a number on it, then you're allowed to use it, even if you can't observe it. But it must come from an equation. It must come from a certain set of operations that lead to a certain number. It must come from sort of an algorithm of some kind of sort. Now, this became sort of the salvation for a lot of wishy-washy sciences, and it led to this emphasis on something known as operationalism. And it gets its name precisely from this notion that you have certain operations that allow you to measure something that is not measurable. And for any science that has an inferiority complex, psychology, like a lot of these social sciences want to go, hey, we are real sciences too. No, you're not. You're doing science of the mind. You're talking about emotions and all the kind of stuff that is unobservable. You are not allowed to use that in proper science. But then many psychologists come, no, we got numbers. I got this questionnaire, and if somebody fills out this questionnaire, I've got a number at the end of it. I'm doing science as well. So this has basically become the whole trend in social science after this, that yes, you can talk about unobservable things like learning and remembering and even things like emotions and quite recently, happiness. A lot of those things you can actually talk about scientifically if and only if you have numbers attached to it. So this is why psychologists are crazy about things like IQ and concepts like subjective well-being, use questionnaires all the time. If they talk about learning, they tend to talk only about response times and that kind of stuff because there are numbers attached to it. And that is really Descartes' legacy. He determined what we're allowed to do in science up until this very day. Now, cogito ergo sum may still, and this is why I love this phrase, and this is why I love Descartes, because I think he's one of the very few philosophers who has come up with something indubitable, and that's what philosophers really want to do. So we came up with cogito ergo sum. None of you can doubt it. It's absolutely true, and it's something that we have to build all of science upon. And if I had 4 more hours, I would now like to talk about Kant, because this is what Kant picks up a little bit later, and I hope there will be a Studium Generale lunch lecture later about Kant, because Kant basically takes this starting point of Descartes and actually does a bit what Euclid does to figure out, if I think therefore I exist, what can we deduce from that starting point? And Kant deduces space and time and everything that's good. So I hope you will come back for the Kant lecture at some later point. And I will restrict myself at that point and I'll let you throw in some questions. Thank you.